to intercede for the common weal of the West. And so I feel that the militia sort of resented the... I think they felt more than they should have that they were relegated to an unimportant role. And I think I spoke to, of course, many of the leading militia people, and they explained the whole situation, and they were thoroughly satisfied. Mm-hmm. But naturally, if you are a part-time soldier, you'd rather spend all your time that you have driving a tank or shooting a gun. I mean, this is normal and natural. And so would the regular soldier. You tell him that he has a job in an armored regiment or an artillery regiment, that he may have to leave his field pieces behind and take some rescue equipment and rush into front. He says, oh, why the hell doesn't George do that? I want to go up and shoot my artillery. Mm-hmm. Well, so I quite understand the junior ranks resenting it. But I think there are a great number of the senior militia people who are very satisfied with this and believe in it too. Yeah. Certainly I had no real bother in certainly with the militia people with whom I dealt. Mm-hmm. But you're limited. I mean, you can't, chief staff of an army can't go and deal with each person. He must deal through the chain of command. There was some resentment, yes, but I think others undertook this task very well.
There's another aspect of his policy, and again, it wouldn't be fair to say that he started it. I think perhaps that under his short period that he stimulated, and that was the policy of integration, of, shall we say, getting together the padres, the service corps, the engineer corps, the maintenance of barracks, and this sort of thing.
Agreed.
Recruiting centers, I believe.
Yes, this is so. And he certainly wasn't an opponent of it at all. In fact, I think that he had the same sort of problem that any minister has when he faces a situation like this. There's always resistance and resentment. Mm-hmm. And but the amalgamation we had, as you know, before, the only service that was completely in common during the war was the dental service.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the time he came in, the army had taken over responsibility, the Army Service Corps had, for feeding, supplying of rations, except to the Navy on the East Coast and on the West Coast. There were separate depots. We had ours, and we had the Navy who built the ships, but they hadn't taken that one step to do away with these two rather than to put it from our depot layers. And in the case of the Air Force, at places like Marville, naturally, you buy a lot from the local area. They did this in their own, but the supplying of their rations and all their installations here was an army one. Well, the next move, the studies that he undertook, was the amalgamation of the medical.
Oh, yeah.
Of the medical services, the padres. And again, I'd have to look at some papers, but I believe that, well, I know who made the studies. They were in hand when I came to CGS, and I think it was completed, yes, because the Surgeon General, I think the first one, really in a tri-service basis, this post was created by Mr. Burke. And studies were going on to amalgamate Provo, pay services. These studies were underway, and I would think that he should get credit for this. I don't think criticism, the two ways of doing it, you can do it too quickly or too slowly. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe he did it too slowly. Some people believe that recently it's been done too quickly. Mm-hmm. No, I don't know.
Yeah.
If someone had got a pace halfway between,
he said
it might be better.
That he would have continued it had he remained in office.
Oh, I'm sure he would have. I'm sure he would have.
We were talking about this, I think, about 2 weeks ago. He felt that the present minister has gone at it much too quickly, has used a club and various other things, he agrees with the general intent of integration, but perhaps without unification. In other words, without doing away with all the traditions, but nevertheless, streamlining the forces and getting them closer together. I think he feels that he might be criticized for not going as far and as fast in that direction as he might have gone.
I don't think that would be a fair criticism. He was working towards these ends and promoting them. So has Mr. Hellyer been doing this. Now, some people say Mr. Hellyer has gone too quickly. Some may say he's gone too slowly. Mm-hmm. But they're both trying to achieve the same objectives. Now, therefore, one does it one way and one another. They're both criticized. Now, what they're both to get credit for is that we're both moving in the direction, and the rate at which they move may be open to criticism, but what is the perfect solution? I don't know. I'm not sure what the perfect speed of doing this is. And certainly, we all knew during the war that whenever there was a large operation, we had a supreme commander, Eisenhower, we had other supreme commanders in all the various theaters. You couldn't have three different services all independently fighting their own battles. They worked together. This came with certain knowledge to us.
He brought that out too, the very same thing, that the wartime cooperation, the fact too, and this is a point I must say that I hadn't thought of, but it had an impact on him. His own position from about October 42 until 45, when he was GOCNC on the Pacific Coast, Guanala, that meant that he created a headquarters that was combined.
You couldn't run the thing effectively without
them. Yeah.
So the thing is, I think all military people, not all military people, but I think the bulk of the senior people in the military agree that when you're making overall defense plans, you have to have a joint staff.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have. It doesn't make sense to have an independent Navy, Army, and Air input. To whom? If there isn't an overall staff, it goes to the minister. Can the minister, who may not be trained or skilled in this business, not a life work, sort these out and make one comprehensive overall plan? No. The plan for the optimum use of the plan for the best organization that you can have, and the optimum use of this within the money available, must be a staff plan. And it takes a big staff to work this out. And they have to consult with other armies and other forces, navies and air force, and learn from other people, and you try to evolve a very effective plan. So I would say that he certainly worked towards that end, and the point is, if he hadn't done some of these things, would they have been as far ahead as they are now? In other words, somebody has to grasp the nettle in this. And I would certainly say that he was working towards his end.
Well, now, I would agree with that.
And the fact that that the Chief of Defense Staff was not, if we had a Chairman Chief of Staff, the fact that that there wasn't appointed in his time the Chief Defense Staff, how do we know that wouldn't have happened in 1 year, 2 years, 3? We don't know. It might have happened as soon as it's happened here. I think we were probably about that time. Dickie Montfatten was named Chief of Defense Staff in UK. And I think any prudent person says, well, let them try it for a little while, unless it's an emergency. Let them try it. Let's watch it. Let's learn from it and see if we do it exactly the same way, or in speaking to him, he may say, well, if we were doing it again, we'd do it this way. So I feel that he should get credit for what he's done in that, towards that end.
There's one thing that surprised me. It's surprising, perhaps it shouldn't, but I suppose it's a a preconceived picture one has of him before I got to know him. Certainly to meet him, he still has his English accent. He's a very picture of, shall we say, almost the Gilbert and Sullivan, Gilbert and Sullivan, British Major General.
Yeah.
And one thinks, perhaps, on slight acquaintance with him, as being very pro-British, imperially minded, this, that, and the other thing. But the surprising thing to me was how well he got along with the Americans and how much he liked them, mm-hmm. as he seemed to.
Yeah.
Now, this may be a false impression that I'm getting, but by them, he speaks very highly of the Americans. He admired their efficiency. He was quite willing to adopt ideas from them, to work far more hand in glove with them, and take a very realistic viewpoint of Canada's position and Canada's reliance on the United States, as compared with others in the cabinet who still had this pro-British feeling, and the prime example, of course, of Mr. Green, who and one or two others, including Green, who I suppose were thinking in terms of Canadian nationalism, to keep the big brother, keep the Uncle Sam away. But this, that there appears to be no part of that in Burke.
No, I don't think so. I agree with you. Naturally, I knew the American military establishment very well.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always, as a minister too, he was always, if his opposite number came, the minister came from the States, he always wanted to have the chief of staff in. We were family. We were his family. He's very, I think he was very attached to his immediate military family. And I think they respected him, and there was no doubt about it. When he ever had a chance to go down and see some new things, he would go down.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never at any time detected the slightest bit of anti-Americanism at
mm-hmm.
all.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was... perhaps, I suppose, it may be, there may be an explanation for it. I think if you are a sailor, a soldier, an airman, you normally feel very close to the soldiers, sailors, and airmen of other countries. I mean, it's like a big club. If you mm-hmm. are a soldier or a sailor and you go off to England, United States, or the Argentine, you'll be invited, even if they're not NATO, if they know you are, well, come on over. And immediately, it's like having, being a member of the club.
Yeah.
So, as an old soldier, he felt that he was talking military business, and he was talking to friends of his. And I would think he liked them very much, and certainly and when you move from the political to the straight military level, mm-hmm. and you have old friends, if they think somebody is, a little hostile, they would do it very carefully, seeing you once, but they might say to you, well, why do you feel that he's a little aloof from us? Never that with George. Never. Never. No, I would think he did this very well. As a matter of fact, he's a man of great charm. And I don't think if he were talking to, I'm going back to people who've been talking to, General Rivera and that French organization, so he could along with them just as well as did Americans. I mean, to the extent it's possible, without the language sometimes, if you don't, each one doesn't speak the other's language, you're not as close. I mean, it's not because you don't want to be, it's just that conversation, rapport doesn't come as easily if you're not on that in language. But I found him, very much liked and very much respected.
And yet, on the other hand, from the political point of view, this seems to have placed him, or at least the Conservative Party, in a fair amount of hot water. I don't know if you remember the times, but one can just read the newspaper editorials and the magazines and journals and whatnot. There was a great deal of fuss being made during his period. The press was very hostile against what appeared to most people to to be Canada's reliance on the U.S., and a great many people saw Canada slipping under the thumb of the U.S. and all that. Do you remember that? I suppose you would.
Yes, I do. But well, perhaps to put it too bluntly, it's like some people resenting charity.
yes, that's well put, I think.
The fact remains, as I see it, that in the West, the United States is the predominant military power. In my experience, they never talked down to us at all. And certain aspects of the Army, I know our arrangements were absolutely first class. I mean, we could send, and did send, our people to all the schools where they had their advanced equipment. And then we found in a very short time they became instructors there. And times we had difficulty getting them back again.
Is that right?
Oh, yes. We had them teaching down there.
Oh, we did.
Oh, yes. Well, and we had, I guess, the best arrangement. Most of our pilots were trained. The Air Force paid for it. RCF paid for their training down. We'd pay a damn cent. But all the, well, Guy Simmons' boy, you know Guy Simmons.
Mm-hmm.
Well, his boy is he's one, I just name him. Mm-hmm. He's a very bright youngster, in the top of his class and this sort of thing. We sent him down on rocketry and whatnot, and he stayed down there teaching, as many others had. They just didn't want to let him go. I think we noted the difference in insignia, that they had a couple of bars where we had pitched or something like this, but heavens. And all these arrangements were... Now, if any minister hadn't liked these, he would have started to dry up, you know, the association. No, there isn't any doubt about our dependence. Dear God.
This came out loud and clear with a great many...
If we put up some barriers... We put up enough barriers between ourselves and America just to feel that we're more independent, we're more this and more that. Who will it react upon most unfavorably? Ourselves.
Yeah.
We have trade arrangements with them. We have all these things. Carry out research. In research generally, while government may do it, I don't know what percentage of the gross national product we spend in research in the government compared to the United States, I mean, percentage-wise.
Mm-hmm.
But in industry, they do a tremendous amount more than we do here.
Yeah.
This, in one way or another, comes over to us.
Yeah.
And now, I suppose there are odd people who feel resentful that there is this unfavorable balance of exchange and that this and that. We have to take certain American equipment, or we do it because we can't afford to build it. I think this is a great pity. And I think that if he were criticized for this, I would take it more as a compliment to him than a criticism, because a man who can get along with these people and get along very well with them without losing his position or dignity, which he never did do, or ever feeling that Canada was subordinate in any way, but realizing the facts of life, not something to condemn the man for.
No,
I know you don't, I'm just saying.
No, I don't, but it seems to be, shall we say, a political fact, and the greatest problem, as you know, how shall I put it? I think one can put it this way, in part, that during the late 1950s, there was a very obvious, one might almost say positive, and open turn in Canadian defense policy from the old traditional reliance on Britain, imperial connection, to this reliance on the United States. There was a shift. Now, I know that this shift had started, shall we say, from the time of Hiroshima, from the time the bomb went, from the time the war ended. But it became obvious at this time, very obvious, and more especially with the atomic bomb, and that they're welled up in Canada an open feeling of resentment that this change was taking place. Maybe the old loyalist spirit was coming out. I don't know what the devil was.
Well, this thing, this very change, had been on the way for a very long while. I remember writing a paper and getting rather criticized for it by some, not long after the war, saying that I thought we should change entirely to American equipment. Now, I think a soldier looked at this not from a point of view of national boundaries or historical connections or anything else, but you're simply looking at ways and means of doing your job better. Well, we know perfectly well when we started in this country after the last war trying to make certain British equipment, their problem came up immediately on threat. Whitworth and our own. Then we tried to resolve this, and we had what was once called the Ottawa thread. This was a hybrid that would take either the Whitworth or the American standard threading. But the whole production method, the production base in England, was not big enough to look after themselves and look after us too, certainly historically, because they were either under attack, and in the last war, the one before, they weren't, but you had to put raw materials. Our automobile industry is a satellite, if you like to call it, of that in the United States. In fact, for many years, the designs were all made there. In fact, today, if you're driving a Ford car or a Chevy or a Buick or any of these, where is it designed? It's not designed. It's designed there. So, if you are going to either produce yourself or be able to rely on others to produce for you, it seems obvious that our great neighbor to the south is the place you're going to get us. Now, and this moved and moved, and valiant attempts were made to produce things wholly Canadian. And I suppose we as Canadians resented at times that the Americans wouldn't take what we regard as a better idea of ours and theirs and take our weapons. There isn't any doubt about it, the incorporated ideas. Well, as far as I was concerned, I was quite satisfied with an arrangement like this. So there was this move, but to me it made compellingly good sense. It was realizing, facing factors. We bought the Centurion tank, but if we go into another series of tanks and replace it, I would doubt very much. I don't know, but I doubt very much it would be a British tank, because they simply haven't had the money to go on producing new families of them, as the Americans have. When we produced our new military vehicles, their Fords and so, and they're identical with the American pattern, there was no problem to assemble them all and build parts of them here. So, to me, there was so much compelling logic about it. But often, if you're following a path like this, thinking only of the logic or the good sense of it, if you're very nationalistic, you can say, well, you're cutting the ties here or there or overemphasizing them. I don't think this is really fair. I mean, do you hang on to an historic tie even though it doesn't make good military sense? Now, you might do it in culture, language, and things of this sort, which doesn't come to a test in a battle. But I think when you're producing the hardware of survival, that you have to be very realistic about this.
I agree with you. And trying to get some sort of a picture from his particular point of view, it would appear that he thought very realistically and very very practically, but nevertheless he was confronted in the cabinet with this emotionalism of Green and Diefenbaker and one or two others. He didn't give me a complete breakdown in the cabinet who was for him, who was against him, but I mean these are so well known that I don't think they're confidential or anything of that nature, but He was really on the horns of a dilemma. And
well,
the liberals, of course, used or made political hay out of this, as of course any party in opposition would.
Well, I'm an old soldier, so I'll comment on the military part of it. But I would think that he was trying to do the best military job he could. Now, if in doing this, it did bring up political factors in his own government, I think this could be quite possible. It did. But he was, first of all, a soldier, and secondly, a politician. And at his age, I don't think you switch very rapidly. And whether those with whom he disagreed were right or wrong, their emphasis may have been on political considerations.
They were.
The width of those political considerations is not for me to judge, it's for other people. But his, I think, was more directed towards an efficient organization. Now, I don't say other people wanted an inefficient one, but they may have placed a greater weighting on factors to which he wouldn't give the same weight.
Mm-hmm.
And if this brought him into criticism, I would think it's more a comment that he was more this way and that. But some people may say, well, I criticize you for that attitude. I wouldn't.
Well, certainly, from what I've heard from him and from others, there was this pull in one direction from the practical point of view for what was best for the forces,
yeah,
which he had to consider. And yet, there's no getting around it. On the other side, what he wanted to do for the forces, anything he wanted to do for the forces meant money.
Definitely.
And money wasn't in control of political hands. And at that time, the public attitude was hostile to this movement towards the Americanization, one might almost call it, which put him in a pretty damn difficult position.
I think it's difficult. I think the Department of National Defense is a difficult portfolio.
Always.
Very difficult. I mean, I know now that the Department of National Health and Welfare and people like this spend as much, and it may be more now. But these are all payments arising out of legislation, the old age pension.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a certain age, you get it whether you want it or not. The baby bonus, they arrive out of legislation.
Yeah.
And once that decision is made and it's on the books, no one's going to change it. All that revises the amount. But, and these aren't, well, when I say they're not manageable. Certainly you could manage it by saying we cut the old age pension in half, but that's political suicide. So the only flexibility, the big budget, was military, the one where there could be flexibility. And there's no doubt about it, they're big spenders, and this brings undoubtedly a minister who's really, you know, keen on giving the best to his department, possibly in conflict. I'm not suggesting for a moment the government as a whole doesn't want to do it, but they probably take more considerations. The other man is the minister responsible and feels a personal responsibility, and he also feels a responsibility to the cabinet. But there's no doubt about it, when they don't get certain things they want, that it hurts the minister too. The other people are disappointed, he's disappointed.
That's right. And he, I think, especially,
yes,
would feel this way. Because
he was a military man.
Yeah.
So he felt it hurt him both ways.
Yeah. And so, he felt more or less of his family. As you mentioned, he was
the father of the family hadn't provided what the family had expected of him. And while he had this great presence that he has, you know, you feel he was really, you know, a shell on him like a Brazil nut.
Yeah.
He didn't have a shell like that for his military family. He adored them, you know. He really loved them. And but the one thing I'll say, he was... He was very careful. If he had these disagreements, and you could see if he did have these disagreements, if he had these disappointments, I think he did his very best to be his own counsel on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was a very loyal member of his cabinet. I mean, he wasn't the sort of guy that said, well, I'd give it to you all boys if I had my way. You know, well, he did everything he could for you, but he never... He didn't take it out in the other his other colleagues. I admired him very much for this.
What would you say during your term at CGS when you would know him, or at least when you would be affected by him and you would know him better? What were his main contributions during your time as you reflect on them?
Well, these will not be in any order, because I haven't thought them out. A thing like this, you'd mark them all down, and you study them, and you give them a particular weighting. There isn't any doubt in my mind that insofar as we have civil defense plans and the ability to carry them out, he was responsible for that. I mean, I don't criticize any ministry before that may have had this task. But when it was taken over from the Minister of National Health and Welfare into defense, he supported it. He supported it, and he put money, he allocated the allocation of money and time and so. And I think that they had built up a fairly good organization. And we did not have one before.
No, Lord.
Now, this isn't a criticism. Before, at one time, this was handed over. Early days, when Brooke Paxton was minister, to National Health and Welfare. But at that time, one trial and two atomic bombs had gone off in New Mexico, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I think a lot of people were so very hopeful that this was such exotic science that the stupid Russian who took his batteries to bed at night to keep them warm wouldn't have it for a millennium. I think our intelligence was very poor in this. I think we didn't make a fair assessment of that side. Our sort of civil defense plans were not geared to the threats that were building up. Mm-hmm. And I think from his time on they were. I think that was a very positive contribution. He certainly made a start, and therefore one can't say how far it would have gone as he remained minister. He certainly made a start in bringing, and the examination and the bringing together of services which could serve all three services. Now, whether that would evolve into a more unified organization, there's no use trying to contemplate, but it was a start in saying, well, fine, one organization can pay everyone, one can look after the medicine, one can look after this and that. So there was a start on this road under him. There is no doubt, I would say, from the Air Force point of view, that he certainly entered into both the arrangement, the spirit of full cooperation with NORAD, and in the organization and deployment of forces which would have met the threats as they were evaluated at that time. There isn't any doubt about this. I think very often we, but this is aside, and the Army felt that they were getting, much more than their share than they should have gotten. I think this is a normal thing because they're a family. But he supported this fully, and I think he... Now, the fact that the day has come when these radar chains may not be necessary, some of them, the mid-canal line is no longer regarded as a necessity, but this doesn't mean anything at all. The bow and arrow isn't really needed now either. But time has gone on, and it's time that has changed this, not the judgments, I think, that were made at that time. Those at the moment are the... He certainly backed the Army, and it's certainly the Army at the time felt very strongly that we had to move into the field of nuclear arms. This isn't an easy decision, and he was the minister to whom we got the Honest John. Mm-hmm. Now, whether we should have got the Little John or the Honest John or some other damn thing, There were limited choices. He backed this. So this was a modernization of things. Excuse me. It rips off us. for approving the design. We have to approve the design of all government buildings, and we had a few strips torn off us for building this, for allowing this awful, dull, terrible building to be built. I don't know what our library is supposed to look like, Ron, but I don't know. But, well, this is the thing. At least we've got honest difference of opinions.
Yeah.
I think when the new parkway is completed and it's opened and the landscaping completed, next year there'll be flowers. I think people will like it very much. But
well, certainly the inside of it is gorgeous.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I have
far away.
A bit more here. Well, I only have about 5 minutes.
Okay.
And in a way, there's so much more to be said, and it's hard to know because a lot of this is political.
Chat with you, Victoria. See, I'm not retired at the moment. I'm still in the Army.
I see.
So I'm always guarded what I say anyway.
Right.
But
Well, I'll tell you what. It might be an idea if when you do come out in Victoria, I see you again out there because I'll be nearer to the point of writing at that time. There's a great deal, of course, about the Beaumark, the Beaumark 1, the Beaumark 2, but most of it is political.
Mm-hmm.
A great deal of it, of course, has to do with Mr. Diefenbaker and the statement that he makes in one hand, and I mean, he'll say one thing here and another thing there.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff on which possibly you may have your own opinion.
Yeah.
There's much that has been said already in interviews I've had with people about Mr. Diefenbaker that's not printable, most of it from Charles Fowkes, as you can well imagine.
Oh, I know Charles very well, yes. Have you seen Hugh Campbell?
No, he was a name that was suggested to me. I must
Hugh Campbell was chief of air staff when I was CGS. He's a very old friend of mine, and he's a very forthright individual, very nice man.
I must try and get to see
him. And certainly, I know that there had been times when the Chief of General Staff and Air Staff didn't get along. We certainly got along very well indeed. He was very deeply involved in the whole Beaumark, this whole business, NORAD. He was the Chief of Air Staff at the time. He retired about, I came here in 61, he retired in 62, and he's in town. Hugh Campbell. He's a first class fellow.
Well, I'll phone him. You were still in, you know, yes, I have about 2 minutes. You were still CGS, I would assume, when Harkness came in.
Doug, yes, I was.
How do you compare the two, or is this a fair question? If it isn't, let's go.
I like them both very much. Mm-hmm. I like them both very much. It was very hard when you were there.
I'm thinking in terms of...
Doug is a closer personal friend. He's more my age, and he's a closer personal friend.
Mm-hmm.
They're both damn good fellows. And,
What about approach? I mean, you almost have two generations difference in their age.
I found it easier to approach Doug than I did George.
Yeah.
George and I sometimes didn't. I was very delighted that he'd asked to mention seeing me, because I think I was a thorn in his side at times.
I get the feeling that still with him, that in certain respects he feels that he may have let down you or this one or the other one, not doing as much for you as he would have liked to have done, and yet there was always this damn political issue.
Well, this came out actually when I go up to Government House and I interview him. I'm having an interview lasting about hour to 2 hours, just as I would with you. And of course, when you get interviewing, you are raking up things that happened 10 years ago.
Oh,
and this I suppose comes back.
Yeah, some of these things come back, and they, well, how many times in life have you not thought back in your dealings with your staff or your students or something, that perhaps you left the impression you're a little too tough with them, or thus or so. And I think if he has any feelings like this, it only I give him credit that he did the job as he saw it had to be done, and that if he worries at times that he wasn't able to do all these things, that shows great humanity.
Yeah.
And
I remember him saying one time, especially that, wanting to do something and yet absolutely not being able to get a authority to do it in cabinet or money from the Treasury, and him saying something to the effect that, well, perhaps a stronger minister could have done it, but he did his damnedest to do it, but he couldn't do it.
Well, I think this is a thing where there may be a certain amount of self-condemnation, which is not at all justified.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes,
he wasn't a weak minister at all. And if you carry that philosophy further, all you're going to do is to cause if somebody had been more adamant and more this or that, would it have done any good at all? Would it achieve the objective, or would it simply have soured the whole damn thing? I think he shows great humility when he mentions things like this. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it was the lack of political courage in his part at all. I think the thing is, and it's very hard in your own black heart to realize that Canada was moving back into peace, thank God, and this unfortunate division of East and West started to spring up, and here we were again building up our Navy, Army, and Air Force. We built it down to about 14,000 after the war.
Yes.
Here we were building it all up again. Here we were imposing taxes to bring a defense budget from $300 million to what, 1.6 billion. Well, now, if this doesn't, this caused his colleagues, the Minister of Finance and others, worry.
No, you
simply, I don't care how hard a minister drives, he isn't going to drive that defense budget, except in an absolute all-in-out emergency. He's not going to drive it up significantly. He isn't going to double it in 1 year.